Welcome back. It's a Wednesday, the 13th day of March, 2019. I'm your host, Mark Hall. And since we basically started off with this story yesterday, I guess a follow-up today would be appropriate. To Facebook, very much living up to their oh-so-appropriate moniker, as now unbans Zero Hedge, after having been caught, publicly humiliated, revealed as the anti-free speech hypocrites that they are, and having their tyranny exposed, the private when it suits them socialist media platform has backed off. So for the story and the truth, let's go right to the horse's mouth. Facebook reverses Zero Hedge ban, says Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, claiming it made a mistake. Yep, it begins. It's been a strange 24 hours. On Monday, we first learned that for the previous 2 days, Facebook had banned all Zero Hedge content across all its various mediums, as it went against Facebook's so-called community standards, which they know, to the best of our knowledge, neither we nor anyone else has any idea what they are. A decision which, as they noted yesterday, surprised us for two reasons. Not only do we not have an official Facebook account, but Facebook did not approach us even once with a warning or even notification. So while we were in the dark about what had triggered Facebook, or what was the company's motive, well, maybe that's a bit of a stretch. They're very widely read, they're not knee-jerk leftists, and they have some integrity. Anyway, back to their story. We were humbled and delighted not only with the media coverage this event received, but far more so with the outpouring of support we received from readers from across social media where Zero Hedge had not yet been banned, like Twitter, where figures from various industries and across the political spectrum voiced support and came to our defense, with many condemning what we felt was an arbitrary decision. Among those who spoke up were President Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., Nigel Farage, Peter Thiel's liberal foil at Thiel Capital, Eric Weinstein, InfoWars' Paul Joseph Watson, and many others. And they quote many, many of those at length in this story. Donald Trump Jr., for his part, called the hypocrisy disgusting, saying, "The censorship continues." Nigel Farage, quote, "A total disgrace." Others lashed out at Zuckerberg and called Facebook a bunch of, quote, Orwellian Nazi types. At least one observed that this is probably the best publicity Zero Hedge could get. "Well done," it said, "proud to know you guys. And grind even harder, because it's working." To them and everyone else who reached out, said the piece, either to us or to Facebook, or said something in private or on the internet or web, our sincerest gratitude. Then on Tuesday morning, they noted, everything had suddenly returned to normal. And whether due to the unexpectedly widespread support we received, or because Facebook had made a sincere error, the ban was reversed. And while they've yet to contact us directly, it continued, they did comment with a Facebook spokesman saying, "This was a mistake with our automation to detect spam, and we worked to fix it yesterday." Unquote. Well, we still have no insight into what article or articles Facebook decided was sufficiently spammy to block everyone's access to our content, or on what basis Facebook's automation and human review had made the decision to quarantine our small website from the rest of Facebook's 2.3 billion monthly users. We're still heartened by this development, not so much because it means a rebound in our traffic. As we observed yesterday, we're lucky in that Facebook represents a tiny source of our inbound referral traffic, but because it means nothing changes. We can and will continue as before, with zero adjustments to our writing style, and we will certainly continue with our highly critical coverage of all things Facebook. And best of all, it'll be read on Facebook, allowing users of the world's biggest media company to escape an informational echo chamber and be presented with contrasting opinions, which, even if wrong, will still allow countless readers to make more informed opinions than if they were served with pre-approved, uniform, and ideologically palatable content. This story comes from Zero Hedge as well. It's about the continuing drama surrounding Boeing's new 737. It's called the MAX 8, and it's under considerable pressure, as you may have heard, and countries and airline fleets around the world are grounding them now after the second crash in a number of months. The latest over the weekend when an Ethiopian Airlines jet crashed, killing all 157 people on board after what looks like an uncommanded pitch down. Although there's certainly no shortage of speculation and obfuscation
investigation on what caused the crashes.
Overnight, their shares listed in Frankfurt shed another 2% to six-week lows, following a 6% fall in New York on Tuesday, which pushed the entire Dow Jones Industrial Average down 0.4%, as more and more countries ground their 737 MAX 8 fleets,
which puts the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration under mounting pressure as well.
According to CBS News, they're facing growing criticism for continuing to back the airworthiness of the 737 MAX 8 as more and more countries, including now China, ground their fleets. Curiously, notes the Zero Hedge summary, this is a reversal of the conventional wisdom where the rest of the world typically takes its cues from the U.S. FAA, long considered the world's gold standard when it comes to aircraft safety. Yet, aviation safety regulators in dozens of other nations have now decided not to wait for the FAA to act and have grounded the planes or banned them literally from their airspace. In addition, at least 10 airlines worldwide have stopped flying them.
As Airheads reported on Tuesday, the EU's Aviation Safety Agency, which covers 32 different countries, announced Tuesday it was banning planes from flying in its airspace, and other countries that have either grounded or temporarily banned the plane include China, the United Kingdom, Indonesia, India, Singapore, Oman, Malaysia, Vietnam, Australia, the UAE, and now New Zealand. Said Chad Oland, a RAND Corporation senior engineer in Washington, the FAA's credibility is being tested. The Chinese want their regulatory agency to be considered a similar gold standard. And no surprise, from the District of Criminal Swamp, the usual suspects are piling on, trying to make points, calling for the planes to be grounded. The New York Times, meanwhile, is reporting that early Tuesday, Dennis A. Muhlenberg, the chief executive of Boeing, called and spoke to President Trump on the phone, making the case that the 737 MAX planes should not be grounded in the United States, according to those briefed on the conversation, reiterating, quote, our position that the MAX is a safe aircraft. Others are not calling into question the process used to certify the new airplane after some changes. But the FAA says it's been reviewing all available data and has so far found no basis to ground the planes, prompting John Cox, president and CEO of the aviation consultant firm Safety Operating Systems, to say that countries that have grounded the MAX 8 may have tried to link the Ethiopian and Indonesian crashes, even though investigators have yet to analyze the Ethiopian plane's black boxes. Quote, the FAA is on solid ground so far, said the former airline pilot and accident investigator, but politics may overwhelm them if enough members get together and demand the planes be grounded. Said Sandy Morris, aerospace analyst at Jefferies in London, the string of bans on Boeing MAX jets is unprecedented. Quote, it seems like a rebellion against the FAA, unquote. But when it comes to safety, folks, and federal agencies that profess to provide it, I guess I'd have to step back and offer just one observation. I'd personally be willing to fly a 737 MAX 8 around the world long before I'd be willing to allow a 5G cell phone anywhere close to anybody I cared about. And I guess the same goes for FDA-approved Frankenfoods, come to think of it. Airline certification processes and accident causes and investigations may end up being quite a bit simpler to follow than what's going on with Brexit, however. Unless, perhaps, you just step way back and say, hey, it's politics and tyranny in action. A Brexit insider, quoted by author Vox Day, just summarizes it this way. As expected, Theresa May has continued her failure theater. Quote, there is no method for Britain to exit from the terms of the withdrawal agreement unilaterally if there are simply intractable differences between Britain and the EU. But since the reason that we're leaving the EU in the first place is due to intractable differences, of course, those differences are not going to be resolved in the matter of, well, the Irish border. The Attorney General said the legal risk remains unchanged and the fundamental circumstances remain the same. There's a lot more inside baseball in this one, but ultimately, says this author, Britain can still use the 1970 Treaty of Vienna to cancel any international agreement, regardless of whether that agreement includes an exit clause or not. Remember, they note, that the most fundamental principle of English constitutional law, does that still matter any more than the U.S. one does? Anyway, is that no parliament may bind a future parliament. And what's important to remember here is that for the time being, almost no one actually wants Theresa May's deal. For another look, we turn to Tom Luongo via a piece entitled Blackmail, Balderdash, and the Brexit That Wasn't, also courtesy of Zero Hedge, and he says, after a lot of drama, British PM Theresa May came back from Brussels with a breakthrough on Brexit, only it wasn't. While the changes to the protocol that governs the implementation of what's called the Irish backstop are an improvement, they're far from enough to allay the rightful fears of Brexiteers and the Northern Irish. So he says, from the beginning of this process, the EU has been in blackmail mode. They've made it clear that they would not negotiate in good faith or even at all. That much has been clear. But the biggest question has been whether May herself was working in the British people's best interest, or was she simply a stalking horse for further EU integration of the entire continent of Europe. Never forget, he writes, that the EU has imperial ambitions, and all of this is part of it. They want to be the center of the world as the U.S. bankrupts itself while trying to maintain a worldwide empire, fighting against the rise of Russia and China. They sit in the weeds, making Byzantine bureaucratic law and building both a fiscal and political union through these underhanded back doors. And the people of Europe have awakened to it. The Brits voted to leave the EU because of this. Eurosceptic parties are rising all across Europe. And the latest rebuke of the EU came in Austria's Salzburg, a traditional center-left stronghold that just voted for a Lega-style nationalist populist majority. And now you have people like Theresa May, who never supported Brexit to begin with, that are using this negotiating period to hand to the EU everything it wants in that withdrawal agreement and to blackmail the British people into accepting an even worse arrangement than had they not voted to leave in the first place. And that point, he says, cannot be understated, because it's the model for how the EU intends to fight the rising opposition to its rule. The withdrawal agreement, he says, was crafted by Germany to punish the UK for standing up to the inevitability of the EU. And it's a warning and a message to Italy, Hungary, and Poland. It was designed to cause irreparable damage to the UK, with the long-term effects of destroying the major political parties and fanning separatist instincts in Wales and Scotland. And no one is more to blame for this mess than the members of Parliament, who continue to virtue signal about the horrors of a no deal, which the British people have become less and less scared of every day. Poll after poll shows overwhelming rejection of May's Merkel deal, as well as growing support for a no deal Brexit. And if the members of Parliament who continue to go through the pantomime of an existential crisis would just leave it aside and simply say, that's it, no deal it is, that would end the uncertainty and the worry that is now the dominant narrative in what passes for the press. Businesses are relocating, shipments are stopping, etc. All because of Brexit, they argue. No, he says, all because of MPs who refuse to embrace the situation as it stands and face the reality that sovereignty is more important than a quarter or two of tightened belts and some annoying paperwork. Moreover, the biggest fear now is the one which is that Britain ends up being better off if they not only threw off the shackles of the EU, but also its corrupt and, frankly, traitorous leadership. Theresa May's performance in Parliament, admits Luongo, before the latest vote was almost convincing, but as always, when someone's giving you an ultimatum, my way or the highway, it's masking an alternative choice. The Dublin Unionist Party and the European Research Group within the Tories understand this. I suspect that in his heart of hearts, even Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn does too. And the reason for this is May was always on their side. It's not a negotiation when there's only one side represented. And this is why Juncker et al. Refused to negotiate in any meaningful way, because they didn't have to. And what that means is that all of this is simply blackmail. What's obvious, watching British parliamentarians at this late stage, says Tom Luongo, is that a majority of them are unwilling to face reality, that the EU is not in their best interest, because any organization that would blackmail rather than negotiate is not an organization any decent person would want to be a member of. Fears of a no-deal Brexit are overblown. And if these same MPs that are so worried about the uncertainty created by the Brexit process would simply end that uncertainty by backing no deal, then certainty would return. The bigger picture, he concludes, is that it's the EU that has the weak hand, not them. But there's still too much politics being played. There's still turmoil in Venezuela. The country's headed back to the Dark Ages, says more than one headline. The hand-wringing and finger-pointing, of course, continues. There's widespread looting all over. The army is overwhelmed, clashing with protesters in some parts of the country and cities like Maracaibo and Caracas. People without water in the major cities are drinking from polluted rivers and even the sewage systems. And as we've already reported, there are concerns that the situation may really be far worse than is able to be reported. The Wall Street Journal has a story up suggesting that the Navy and its partners in industry are, quote, under cyber siege by Chinese hackers and others perhaps with the help of former traitors in the U.S. government, suggests your host, backed by evidence we've talked about here literally for years, who have stolen tranches of national security secrets over recent years, now exploiting critical weaknesses that threaten the United States' standing as the world's top military power. This according to a new internal Navy review delivered to Navy Secretary Richard Spencer last week and reviewed by the Wall Street Journal, which depicts a branch of the armed forces under siege and basically in turmoil. And separately, there are, of course, investigations into that very treason allegedly in progress. And no, don't hold your breath on any of that ever becoming public, at least from the politically correct waste stream. Much less seeing perpetrators actually prosecuted, ending up in orange jumpsuits or swinging from scaffolds. So what is the really big smokescreen or story today so far as the waste stream is concerned? Would you believe it involves crime, corruption, bribery, and of course, Hollywood? And no, it's certainly not pedophilia or sex slavery. That's not getting any more press than it ever has. But rather than CNN or entertainment tonight, let's go to Across the Pond for the Daily Mail headline. It says actresses Lori Loughlin and Felicity Huffman are among 50 people charged in a massive college entrance exam cheating scandal in which parents paid $25 million in bribes to get their kids into elite schools like Yale, Georgetown, and Stanford. Full House star Lori Loughlin and Oscar nominee Felicity Huffman, it begins, are among two of the 50 parents and coaches charged in a plot to get their children into schools, including not only the aforementioned, but UCLA, USC, the University of Texas, Wake Forest, and others. The scheme was uncovered, it says, by none other than the FBI and federal prosecutors in Boston. And it involved parents paying bribes of up to $6 million to get their children into these elite schools. In many instances, the children were unaware that their parents had paid these tax-deductible bribes, according to federal documents, and most of those charged either paid to get higher SAT scores or faked an athletic resume that, along with the participation of a bribed college coach, helped the children get accepted to a college as a team recruit. Prosecutors said in court on Tuesday that some of the students also lied about their ethnicity on applications, who could have thought it in politically correct America with a K, in order to take advantage of affirmative action. And there's lots and lots more, but you get the picture. It's being called the largest college admissions scam ever prosecuted by the Department of Just Us. Not to be confused with the largest treason scam or the largest undermining of the Constitution scam or all the other real crimes that are pretty much being ignored while idiots try to send their stupid kids to schools where they can be even more indoctrinated than their parents are. Oh, and on that score, I do have to kind of hand it to White House Counselor Kellyanne Conway, who nailed it when she tweeted yesterday evening, quote, "They're worried their daughters are as stupid as their mothers." All of that, however, does bring me to this very ironic and I would say related story, courtesy of Michael Snyder via the Economic Collapse blog. Tyler Durden of Zero Hedge reposted this one, too. Millennials, he writes, are more than $1 trillion in debt, and most of them don't even own a home. They're deeper in debt than any other generation that's come before them, and the biggest reason, he says, may surprise you, or again, it may not. Yes, it's student loan debt. And I don't think that even includes bribes in order to get themselves indoctrinated. And here he quotes the Business Insider to say that while the debt levels accumulated by millennials eclipse those of previous generations, the complexion of that debt is very different. According to a 2018 report from the St. Louis Federal Reserve Bank, mortgage debt's about 15% lower than millennials, and credit card debt among millennials was about two-thirds that of Gen X. However, their student loan debt was over 300% greater. And ask yourselves, folks, what they got for that. Over the last 10 years, says Snyder, the total amount of student loan debt in the United States has more than doubled, while the general level of actual education has gone down by who knows how much. But the anecdotal evidence suggests they're dumber than a box of rocks. And if nothing else, their student loan debt alone proves that they've learned pretty much nothing except how to be debt slaves, oh, and then turn to socialism to fix their problems. Says Forbes, the latest student loan debt statistics for 2019 show how serious the student loan debt crisis has become for borrowers across all demographics and age groups. There are more than 44 million borrowers who collectively owe $1.5 trillion in student loan debt in the U.S. alone. And student loan debt is now the second highest consumer debt category, behind only mortgages, and higher than both credit cards and auto loans. Borrowers from the class of 2017, on average, owe $28,650, according to the Institute for College Access and Success. And what makes all of this even more depressing, writes Snyder, is the fact that, as I've already kind of indicated, folks, the quality of so-called higher education in the U.S. has literally gone down the toilet over recent years. And Snyder has a companion piece, too, to show how successful the debt education has really been. It's called 12 Statistics That Prove the United States is Facing a Consumer Debt Apocalypse. Number one of which is total consumer debt in the United States just surpassed the $4 trillion mark, which has, of course, never happened before in all of U.S. history. And when you throw in mortgages and all other kinds of individual debt, U.S. consumers are now $13.5 trillion in the hole. A whopping 480 million credit cards are in circulation in the country. That's up nearly 13% since 2015. And U.S. consumers are carrying $870 billion worth of balances on those cards right now. 56% of Americans, in fact, currently have credit card balances that they've been carrying for more than a year, while the number of seriously delinquent credit card accounts in the U.S. has shot up to 37 million. But wait, there's more. Americans now owe a total of $1.3 trillion on their auto loans, of which more than 7 million Americans are delinquent, surpassing the total that we saw during the peak of the last recession by about a million. And of that $1.5 trillion of record student loan debt, more than $166 billion of it is considered to be seriously delinquent. Finally, millennials are more than $1 trillion in debt, making them the most indebted generation in American history so far at this stage in their lives. And one recent survey found that fully 78% of all Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. And if you think debt might have something to do with it, you're probably on the right track. All of which means there's very little room for error, notes Snyder. And to bring that point home, he quotes the chief economist at Moody's Analytics, Mark Zandi, who sounded downright gloomy, he notes, when he recently said, "The economy is throttling back, way back." That's the message in the near stall out of job growth last month. Business, he said, as a result, are nervous and sentiment is at the risk of breaking if anything goes wrong. And yes, plenty could go wrong. A recession could materialize swiftly if businesses lose faith, and there's a good chance that they will. And when that happens, concludes Michael Snyder, things are going to get very, very rough for U.S. consumers, particularly those carrying massive credit card debt. Maybe we'd better start to wrap up with at least a bit of good news, if you can call it that. Speaker of the Traitors, Nancy Pelosi, said in an interview that she now opposes moving to impeach the president, even though she believes he's unfit for office, and she ought to know what unfit amounts to, folks. She's surrounded by it. But this is her first definitive statement on the subject, says even MSN, even though it might alienate members of the socialist left intent on ousting the president by any means necessary. "I'm not for impeachment," she said in a March 6th interview conducted for a future issue of the Washington Post magazine. "This is news," she added. "I haven't said this to any press person before, but since you asked, and I've been thinking about this, impeachment is so divisive to the country that unless there's something so compelling and overwhelming and bipartisan, I don't think we should go down that path because it divides the country, and he's just not worth it." Unquote, and good grief. Yeah, what's changed, you're probably asking, other than after 2 years of looking for dirt anywhere, anyway, and even bringing liars to the fore, they haven't been able to come up with squat. And given the smoke from everywhere else, maybe there is more going on behind the scenes. And given all of that, maybe we should give the president the last word. He started off hot on Wednesday, says one summary, saying that while he greatly appreciates Nancy Pelosi's statement that she's now again impeachment, quote, "everyone must remember the minor fact that I never did anything wrong," unquote. Well, yes, Mr. President, but while that's true, by now you ought to know that that has nothing to do with anything. prompting Nancy Pelosi to say, I don't usually talk about him this much. This is probably the most I've talked about him. I hardly ever talk about him. You know, it's not about him.